Good morning. It's Sunday, August 7th. If you've been following online, it's been a while. Had sort of an impromptu but much necessary month off. Contact me privately if you're really interested in the details. Where we last left off with our politics of exclusion in Judaism, we've been discussing Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox. And the last part that we left off was when Saul Lieberman went from just being a professor of Talmud to actually part of the rabbinical school, in that it wasn't just that you were, you know, earning a living by teaching, but you're actually putting your name to the graduates, in which case, difference between, say, being a faculty member, where you could just, you know, say, yeah, guy's just picking up a paycheck, versus really giving an endorsement to what's going on in the university. So for this week, we're going to focus a little bit more on some of the seminaries at university. I apologize. I don't know if it, well, we'll actually. Yeah, well, that's actually a quote that, you know, we get into the first paragraph. Today we're going to focus on the Haredi approach, which won't come as much of a surprise. Next week we'll get to some of the more modern approaches, just to let know, or, you know, reactions to it. Yeah, I mean, you can guess, based on what we've seen so far, that the Haredim would, you know, not take too kindly to Saul Lieberman in his position, but we're going to see some of the words used and some of not just the arguments or the rhetoric, but how did the opposition manifest. Okay? That will be, you know, some of the discussion today. Ed, start us off with the first part here.
In 1959?
Yeah.
Lieberman became rector of the seminary, and one of his responsibilities was guiding the general religious policy of the institution.
Right, so stop there. That gets to George's point, where you're no longer just a faculty member. You know, you are now a leader of it. So it's a, you know, if you're talking about affiliation, right, there's a little bit of a change here between you're just employed by an organization versus you're actually part of an organization. Other terms, you know, are you just a union labor? Are you actually management? Are you company? Right? At this point, you know, his response is being the guiding the general religious policy of the institution is he's actually a lot more affiliated with it than just being a teacher. Right?
Thus, there is certainly justice and the assertion that whatever his personal religious commitments, Lieberman had become part and parcel of the conservative movement and was assisting it at the time that the Orthodox were attempting to expose what they regarded as the conservatives' distortions of halakha.
Yeah. So you can imagine the tension here, right, that we've, you know, seen beforehand, that as the Orthodox are trying to say conservative Judaism is somehow invalid, in particular over matters of halakha, Saul Lieberman, who was considered, as we saw in previous weeks, to be, you know, great Talmid Chacham, observant in his own right, now plays for the other team.
Yep. Furthermore, there is no question that the leaders of conservatism were able to use the presence of Lieberman at the seminary to help legitimize the institution when it was challenged on religious grounds. For example, when Chief Rabbi Herzog came to New York, he was willing to meet with some members of the seminary faculty but would not enter the building because Kaplan worked there. Finkelstein recalled telling Herzog, "Can't be as you think if Saul Lieberman sits on the faculty."
If he can't be as bad as you think is probably what the quote. I'll have to check that out. Again, we're quoting from Mark Shapiro's book, Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox. All typos in here are faults of my own. Oh, so it's not just me. Yay! anyway, so here, right, the concerns of legitimization are a very real concern, and this is something, you know, Dan, you had mentioned me in an email privately, are what are some of the reasons why, you know, it's necessary to exclude people, right? So in this case, when you have a great person that signs on to conservative Judaism, when once I try to delegitimize, him being there serves as legitimation for the organization to the point where the organization, at least in Finkelstein's term, will hold up Saul Lieberman to say, well, he's there, how bad could it possibly be? In which case you have two options. You can either say, oh, you're right, meaning that Saul Lieberman is a guttle, is a great person, he's reached a different conclusion. religion, and therefore we should now think differently. Or you can just delegitimize Saul Lieberman, in which case, by quoting Saul Lieberman, it's like, yeah, you know, he went off the derech too. Meaning, when you have a great person, or for lack of a better term, if you have a gadol that says something controversial, you either change your opinions to match the gadol, or you just change his definition of who is a gadol. I remember in YU, one Rosh Yeshiva said, no self-respecting posek would say you can make havdalah on an electric candle. An a light bulb, right? Using, you know, something electric. And I said, but, you know, so-and-so said so. He says, proves my point exactly. Like, no guttle would say X. Well, this guy said X. Well, that just proves he's not a guttle. And there's a bit of a tautology, you know, in terms of how the discourse goes. But, you know, at least in this paragraph, you see exactly why that, you know, problem comes up. Because you have to deal with that dissonance of when you try to revere great people, but great people are the ones that you hold up in a certain way, don't always act in the way that you necessarily want them to. I'm trying to write an essay on this right now, you know, on some of the issues with having, you know, this guttle type of mentality of when you have this sort of dissonance, or in a weird way, you know, you want to have this great person as a guttle to whom you defer. On the other hand, you can have major community reactions against him. In which case, is it really submission to an authority, or is it populism by a different name? But you just don't call it populism. Yeah, George.
Catlin was not in management. So why was his presence objected to?
Yeah.
If before Lieberman became rector, he would not have been objected to.
So, well, actually, it kind of was. We saw that in part two. You know, the very fact that Kaplan was there. So think about it this way. If Lieberman's presence would cause it to be legitimized, Kaplan's presence would do the exact opposite. I mean, the very fact that you hire someone like Kaplan who had a bunch of ideas that were antithetical to Orthodox Judaism, feel free to read up on Kaplan to understand what, you know, Orthodox Judaism and what that meant. Not going to get into his thought, but the fact that they hired him showed that they approve of Kaplan. Right, and they're giving him a forum and a place to teach. Right?
Did Lieberman part of Kaplan?
No, I believe Lieberman came afterwards. But the fact that he joined on when he was there, right? You say, well, if you're going to join the same faculty as someone else who other people might consider a heretic, then what's the point? Right?
Kaplan was a graduate of YU, wasn't he?
I believe so. There was a story that he was the oldest living graduate at the time of the centennial, something like that. Anyway, so this again will set the stage. You know, nothing new that we saw in this paragraph, but it sort of sets the stage for the discussion that we have followed. So here's a really crazy letter. Dan, take the presence of Kaplan.
The presence of Kaplan at the seminary was one of many problems mentioned in the following nasty letter Lieberman received. Dear sir, for the sake of Parnassa and glory, you have sold yourself to the Sitra Ahra, the other side. Do you not know that you are lending prestige to Mordechai Kaplan, Yimach Shemo, and to the other cokerim at the seminary, as well as to the graduates, who are almost in every case Mugulchei Ta'ar and Boale Nida?
To put in the translation, Mugulchei Ta'ar are the people who shave, you know, the razor violating Torah law, and Boale Nida are people who are, you know, do not care about the laws of menstrual purity.
The United States has many rabbinical schools where honest young men are studying Torah and developing Talmidei Chachamim. Is your presence at the seminary necessary for the spreading of Torah? Or is the glamour...
That's how it's spelled in the book, which was probably not Shapiro's typo as much as the letter's typo,
right,
given the logic of this letter.
Or is the glamour of being a professor among Amei Haaretz with a comfortable salary so powerful that even Saul Lieberman is not man enough to withstand it? Do not deceive yourself that you will change the seminary. You will be influenced by them, and you will be separated from the klal of Talmidei Chachamim who have not sold themselves to Parnassa. Oy la Rasha v'oy la Shkeino.
Translated as, woe to the wicked and woe to his neighbor.
Better to be a poor rabbi in a little synagogue than a professor who produces rabbis chotim and machtim as harabim.
Sinners and those who cause others to sin.
There is yet time to repent.
Yeah. And notice, right, it's yours truly, a friend, right? So, you know, which is a weird way of a friend writing a letter, aside from the fact that it is anonymous, right? And, you know, we saw, I think, in a previous week, an open letter, you know, that was published to a particular community, and this was, you know, something that was directed towards him. Whether or not this was representative of, now, I mean, you can see in a bit, you know, how representative it was, but it certainly, you know, was, I don't think it was an unusual mode of discourse, right? If you try to break down the logic in this letter, right, you can say, I mean, you're trying to, I guess, play up just how awful the seminary is. One is not just Kaplan, which was a sin in its own right, but also seeks to basically say every single member says almost in every case, which is, you know, clearly a very strong, severe accusation that would in no way be based on any sort of, you know, I mean, there would be very little way of, you know, justifying that, or at least to that degree. Were there people who did not keep halacha at JTS in these, in, you know, at this time? Yeah, probably, you know, just by sheer numbers. Is that necessarily everyone there? Hard to say, right? But this was at least a perception in a certain group, and you can see that in the mode of discourse, not uncommon to what we've seen in previous weeks, it's not uncommon to find hyperbole to basically present, you know, the opposing side in the least positive light possible. All right, Paul, take the next passage. I should mention, I skipped a bit in the book, because he also cites another letter that was addressed to, I think, Finkelstein, that was probably written by the same guy, also anonymously. But
Ginsburg,
I could be mistaken.
In opposition to this letter, from Lieberman's perspective, everything he was doing was within the bounds of halacha, and he was helping rather than hurting the cause of traditional Judaism. Although he regarded himself as an Orthodox Jew, when it came to his students, it was not the denominational label that was important to him, but rather their commitment to halakha.
So stop there for a second here. So one opinion was simply, by affiliating with conservative Jews, you've gone over to the other side, the Sitra Achra, you know, the Kabbalistic idiom for really the devil, or, you know, some equivalent thereof, for lack of a better term. And, you know, but Lieberman had a very different, like, there are different ways of looking at it. Lieberman saw, well, one, I'm within the bounds of halacha. There's nothing prohibited in, you know, teaching in this institution. And he thought that he could actually help students teach Torah. And the important line here was not the denominational label that was important, but rather commitment to halacha, which if you think about, you know, you really want to be a fundamentalist Jew, you don't find anywhere in the Torah Orthodox or conservative. It's, do you keep halacha? Do you not keep halacha? And there are ways of checking that out, meaning is what you do consistent with, you know, you open up a Gemara, open up Shulchan Aruch, open up Rambam, and see, well, is what you're doing consistent or not? So for Saul Lieberman, or at least as, you know, Shapiro is explaining, the main thing is, you know, am I keeping halacha? Am I teaching appropriate halacha? And can I get students to keep halacha better than they otherwise might have? Yeah.
Is there an objective test for keeping halacha? Does it vary from judge to judge?
That is a wonderful, wonderful question. I think yes. A lot of people would disagree with me and a whole bunch of others.
That halacha is open to interpretations. So.
True, but unless you have some objective standard, even if you have a range, you need to have some objective standard by saying what's an acceptable interpretation and what isn't. Right? And there are different methods. We'll probably get to that in a series of classes, you know, next year. Something that I have, you know, in the back of my head that we'll probably do on Tuesdays. You know, but so the truth. Yeah, I mean, it does get a little bit complicated there in terms of, you know, if you think there's an objective halakha, then every Jew would have to be held by one uniform standard. If there isn't one, and in which case it is subjective and somehow dependent on community acceptance, well, then you just basically run with the aforementioned tautology of you just can't go against whatever other people do, regardless of what it is that they're doing. If anyone is interested, you know, maybe listening, I actually have an essay on my website called Popular Practice in the Process of Psi, and part of a whole personal Hashgatha series that kind of addresses that question. but it's a much bigger question than we can handle here. Continue. Thus in a letter?
Thus in the letter to Israel's chief rabbi, Isser Yehuda Unterman, he defends the skill and halachic acceptability of those conservative rabbis who were trained to write Gittin. Similarly, during a dispute over Lieberman's newly formulated ketubah, which was designed to help solve the Agunah problem, and met with strong Orthodox opposition, Lieberman told the members of the rabbinical settlement, "I saw that some of you were accused of being frightened by the Orthodox rabbis. I want to tell you that I am not frightened. I am not frightened by them at all. I want therefore to give you a point of information. In truth, they were frightened, and I want you to know why they were frightened. They weren't afraid that the Beit Din would issue some takanot. Not at all. No, not at all. They were afraid that the Beit Din would issue takanot in accordance with the law. As a matter of fact, one of the very important members of the Orthodox rabbis said in so many words that this Beit Din of the Rabbinical Assembly will issue a takanah that will be...
Takanto kelkalto.
Okay.
A decree of misconduct.
Okay, a decree of misconduct. It will not be a great misfortune because...
It will be a great misfortune
because they will get authority, and that is the reason why they oppose this. Many of them think that the Beit Din will begin to move in this line. The movement can become strong, and it will affect them.
So I remember one of the opposition from the Orthodox, beyond just the school, is when they actually started making their own halakha, right? Or not making their own halakha, but rather making halakhic decisions on their own, independent of giving due deference. Here, Lieber was talking about known to be as the Lieberman clause in the Ketubah that would have. In function, it was actually kind of similar to what the RCA wound up adopting as their own, prenuptial agreement. Just a few differences, but, I think politically here, it was because it came from Lieberman, it was rejected out of hand as opposed to, on the actual merits. If you check out the proceedings of the Rabbinical Assembly, I think we might have discussed this in a few in earlier weeks, they tried dealing with the Aguna issue as early as the 20s. In response to World War I and MIAs. Yeah, and there were, I think it was Rabbi Louis Epstein who records going to Israel and asking rabbis to sign on to it, and they said, this works, but we can't sign on to it because you guys came up with it first. And for Lieberman's perspective, you could almost see there's a certain type of, idealism that you would have of a professor to say, well, the best ideas are going to win out. We're going to do what we can, that will be in the bounds of halakha. We're going to defend it on the grounds of halakha. And they're going to be scared of us because we're actually going to be correct. And perhaps, he felt with that idealism, well, we can then in turn go ahead and change the world, assuming that people ultimately, either act rationally or are more concerned with halakha than they are with the denominational labels, right? Problem with many idealists is that doesn't always turn out. Exactly. Now, we discussed also that, the Orthodox might have been threatened by the conservatives, because the truth is, not everything that might have come out of conservative Judaism at that time was in accordance with halakha. To give one example, in 1948, at the proceedings of the Rabbinical Assembly, Louis Epstein was upset and he complained that the Committee of Jewish Laws and Standards had the power to permit everything and prohibit nothing. And he set up a 12-point proposal. Two of the points were related to following Shulchan Aruch, be it on the sides of stringency or leniency, and that got voted down. So it's really, if you have certain people who might be able to strike nuance and to say this is okay and this is not okay, if you are leaders of communities and the rank and file aren't going to appreciate nuance. They just want to know conservative good, conservative bad, Orthodox good, Orthodox bad. It's really hard to say, well, this part is okay and this part isn't okay. I don't know what people were like back in, the 40s and 50s, but, at least today, it's very hard to actually have a good conversation with someone where you actually can communicate nuance. And people don't always want to hear nuance. They just want to hear good, bad. Right? So, yes, you can, chalk it up to purely something political, but there's also a lot more at stake here, too. Yeah.
Supposing a non-Jewish woman doesn't convert, but she observes every halakha that she's required to observe. Is there any group of Jews that would say that the halakha is what counts because she...
No, because halakha would be, if she hasn't converted, she hasn't converted.
Okay.
All right? So... All right, so this, you know, so this happened, you know, so again we have the division here of, you know, what could have Lieberman's positions possibly have been. Here's a very interesting narrative to see how the, I guess, how things were manifest from Lieberman's side. So this was, he's now going back to 1957, you know, so this is before he became official rector of the seminary, so go ahead.
The alienation of the athletes from Lieberman was clearly seen in 1957. And Lieberman was chosen to receive the Ralph Cook Prize awarded by the municipality of Tel Aviv. Even before the prize was officially announced, the newspaper Sharim, which was published by the Poli Aguda Yisrael, published a story under the heading, "The Ralph Cook Prize Should Not Be Given to One Who Is Unworthy of It." The article notes that traditional Judaism does not distinguish between the authors and their works. If an author is not worthy of being regarded as one of the Torah sages, then his book must be viewed similarly.
This was in particular regarding his Tosefta Kishuta, which I brought in a copy of a couple of weeks ago. I think I put in a quote in part of that. Possibly towards the end. So here you have a case here where, you know, he was about to be awarded for, you know, what remains one of the, you know, greatest works on the Tosefta, and there was already opposition to him receiving a prestigious award because, you know, he wasn't worthy, right? His affiliation made him no longer worthy. So, together with Lieberman, here's where it gets a little more interesting. Rav Meshulam Ra was also chosen to be awarded the Rav Cook Prize, that's definitely my typo, for the publication of his volume of responsa, Kol Mevaser. However, Roth surprised everyone by announcing that he refused to accept the award together with Lieberman. What made this so surprising was that Roth was hardly the stereotypical Haredi extremist. On the contrary, he was a member of the Israeli Chief Rabbinate and a supporter of the Mizrahi movement. He did not arrive in Palestine until 1944, and thus, unlike so many of the other great rabbis there, never had any personal dealings with Lieberman. In Roth's letter of, so which meant was, remember, the letters of approval they had from Lieberman were all from people who actually had interacted with him. He did not, right? So in Roth's letter of refusal to the Tel Aviv municipality, he explained that it was forbidden for him to receive his prize together with a rabbi of a, quote, reform community. In support of this refusal, he recited Divrei Yamim 2:20-37, because thou hast joined thyself with Achaziah, the Lord had made a breach in thy works. He also cited Avot Rabbi Natan 9:4, do not associate with the wicked even for the study of Torah. These are very strong words, especially when one compares them to the glowing titles of honor given Lieberman by Herzog and Unterman, Ross colleagues in the chief rabbinate. So you have someone who never had any personal dealings with Saul Lieberman, who's making his judgment not based on Lieberman himself or anything that he did wrong, aside from his signing on with the seminary. And that was enough to treat him as a Rasha, a wicked person on the level of a Chavya, and to have him apply all of these other verses of do not associate with someone who is wicked. Yeah.
Is there something in the halakha that they could point to and say, aha, what he's doing? I mean, like, I think Shapiro mentioned some halakha that you cannot teach Torah to non-Jews. So is there something that they can point to and say, aha, there's a law that he violates by being there?
And that's a fascinating, you know, question that does come up with you, because you don't have... Well, actually, hold off on that. We'll talk about that when we finish, you know, this section here. Good point. Right, let's get through this part and remind me if we don't get to it. Ed?
Among those who expressed approval for Roth's stand was Rabbi Mordechai Gifter, Rosh Yeshiva of Zatel's Yeshiva in Cleveland, one of the most right-wing yeshivot in the United States. Regarding Lieberman, Gifter wrote that from the time he joined the seminary, he was no longer in the good graces of the Gedolim. Yet, now matters were much worse as, quote, He continues to be associated with it. Even now, when the movement intends to uproot the fundamentals of the faith, and his involvement with the movement is as its chief rabbi, replacement of his predecessor, Professor Levi Ginsberg, is it any wonder that Rabbi Meshulam Waroth concluded that it was forbidden for him to participate in receiving a prize together with the chief rabbi of the conservatives?
Yeah. And in the book, he continues, Shapiro gives, several more examples and a little bit of the back and forth. He also says that, as part of the exchange, Lieberman actually backed out. Right, and he wound up getting a more prestigious award instead. But anyway, I don't remember if Shapiro writes about that. He, remember that Shapiro writes that Lieberman, backed off because he didn't want to be the source of controversy. In continuing with a whole bunch of other citations, continue with one final example.
One final example, when Professor Yitzhak Gilad took the first steps to establish the Institute for Advanced Torah Studies at Bar Ilan University, he was attacked for wanting to create a rabbinical seminary, a concept strongly opposed by the Haredim. In Hamodia, he was compared to Tzuntz, Geiger, Buber, and Lieberman. By looking at the company Lieberman was placed in here, it is clear just how far his reputation has fallen with at least one segment of Orthodoxy.
Yeah, I mean, this was a quote. I mean, even though this happened, this came out later, the fact that someone's going to compare him to Zuntz, Geiger, and Buber, and to say Lieberman's just like the rest of them, is a pretty big, big leap. If people are unfamiliar with them, check it out on Wikipedia. But this is a pretty, once you're saying, like, he's like them, that's more than just, he's no longer a guttle. Take the next paragraph, Paul.
Roth and Gifter regard Lieberman as nothing more than a turncoat whose Torah learning should not be acknowledged, and this was the view of many in the Haredi world. Lieberman's death was not even mentioned in HaKadosh or the other rabbinic journals. And because of the blackout of his name and works, most yeshiva students today have never even heard of him. Haredi authors who deal with his tosefta never even mention his commentary, although many undoubtedly use it. In the recent biography of Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky, who is best known for his monumental commentary on the tosefta, there is a discussion of other commentaries. Needless to say, there is no mention of Lieberman or tosefta the
Kifshuta, the name of the work that he published.
This is so even though Lieberman goes out of his way to praise Abramsky's work. It is also not surprising in the search of Bar Ilan response at CD-ROM reveals that while Abramsky's commentary is cited numerous times, Lieberman's tosefta Ki Fishuta.
Tosefta Kishuta?
Okay. Is referred to just once by the Chiel Yaakov Weinberg.
Otherwise known as the Sfirat Ha'Esh, which makes a whole lot of sense if you know the Sfirat Ha'Esh. The person on whom Shapiro wrote, I think his first major work was on the Sfirat Ha'Esh.
Yechiel Yaakov, but we see the Rosh Yeshiva in Baltimore?
No. He was based out of Israel.
Uh-huh.
Right. So, at any rate, let's focus on, this was just from the Haredi mindset, which was, you could kind of expect, right, the reaction would be extreme, which would be not just to say, he's no longer a guttle, but, I think Shapiro's use of the word turncoat is very apropos to the description of how the Haredim viewed him. Right? I think that seems clear based on what some of the statements here were said.
What I find also curious is that the university, Bar Ilan, sets up this academic institution,
mm-hmm.
part of an academic institution, and yet they are not open to Lieberman's work.
I think Bar Ilan is. The Bar Ilan. Okay, so let me explain about the Bar Ilan CD thing. The Bar Ilan CD, while it is published by Bar Ilan, doesn't have their impromptu on. Like, it's not their giving us come out. What it is a collection on CD of other rabbinic sources. So it's not that they include, in fact, when they print the Tosefta, or at least when they include the Tosefta, they include the Girsa, the version of Lieberman's Tosefta. I don't believe they include his Perush because I don't know if they have the copyrights for those. But when you do a search of the CD of what other people quoted, you see that Lieberman isn't quoted by the other people. Trust me, at Bar-Ilan they study Lieberman. That's not an
it's
issue.
Just that was the impression.
Because the CD is just the reference of it, and it is a good reference to see, well, who else is citing him? If any academics are listening, it's like Web of Science in a way.
Citations.
Bingo. Exactly. Right? So if you search, he's just considered, you know, even though, and we saw this, you know, I think in the first week of how some people dealt with, I know we saw Rav Yosef in his Yerushalmi on Peah, how you don't give credit to people when, even though you might use their works, but you don't want to acknowledge them in any way. So addressing your question, Dan, of could you point to any specific halakha to say you are violating X, Y, and Z? Well, it would come up to a matter of interpretation, meaning, would you be allowed to teach it, you know, a heretical place, like let's say, you know, a Catholic church or a Catholic
Georgetown University?
I wouldn't even say Georgetown University. I would actually say a seminary where they're actually ordaining priests, like Union Theological or something like that, right? To, you know, people, it's like, of course you can't train in a, you know, Catholic institution to train Catholics. You know, that's, you know, pure idolatry. A lot of it's going to be a matter of comparison to earlier texts, which is one reason why we spent so many months going through the rabbinic sources of, you know, Minim, Apikorsim, and different groups and sects, because when you get to later, you know, divisions, people will say, well, this is like an earlier category that were already set up by the sages. Say Reform Judaism too. We saw the terms like Kofrim, Apikorsim thrown around. Those are old rabbinic, you know, examples. And once you make that comparison, you know, you are like another group that was already delegitimized, you know, thousands of years ago, and you use that rhetoric. Whether or not you actually give a position paper to show this proves that, you know, you fall under this category, you can make analogies to today, right, where in order to delegitimize a particular individual, you associate them with other organizations that your constituents are going to be very opposed to. Like on one side, it's like, oh, that person's part of the ACLU. And you'll tell that to people who really don't like the ACLU, and that's enough to say no. Or, you know, that person is part of that party. You know, and it goes the other way, too.
Would the Yale School of Rabbinics be considered a seminary?
I'm not sure.
It's very diverse.
It is diverse. I don't know if Div schools today would come under, you know, that category, but there's also, like, no pretense behind it. You know, I'm just trying to throw out an example there of trying to do that association. What they could have done in terms of, you know, if you could try to set up some logic and why I think people went back to Kaplan, it's like, as long as, you know, once the seminary hired Kaplan and say, we want you to teach, Kaplan's theology was well known, and Kaplan's theology was clearly at odds with traditional Orthodox Judaism. If you want a postulant to say, it's like, yeah, at odds with Torah for, you know, various reasons. I'm not going to give a class on Kaplan right now.
Yes, you could say in Torah, I mean, that's what I am.
Well, that would be one very big part why, you know, Orthodox would have rejected him.
Was he saying that, or was he saying we should include people under the
umbrella? No. This wasn't a pluralist thing. He actually, you know, wrote of and affirmed of himself positions that were neged Torah. And I think that is a fair statement to make based on, you know, his writings. I will refer people to do more research on Kaplan.
I've got to read more. I mean, I've read, but I was under the impression he was from Shabbat. He's according to people who knew him when he was a Talmud.
Well, what he wrote, certainly, you could observe, what you think and what you observe can be completely different. You can keep, well, I don't want to get too involved in, you know, the thought of Kemble. That would take us too far off topic.
Okay.
But let's take the premise for the sake of this logical argument. Why Lieberman would have been, like, how the logic would have gone. Assume for the sake of argument, and if you want to argue privately, we can do that, that Mordechai Kaplan was in fact a kofer b'Torah, kofer b'Ikar. He in fact denied fundamental principles of Judaism. L'halacha, all right? Once the university brings him in to teach, they are giving him a pulpit, so to speak, and saying, we in some way agree with your position or at least include it in an acceptable range of possibilities. So by their acceptance of Kaplan, instead of, you know, either not hiring him or firing him when he writes stuff, are basically giving tacit acceptance to his views. Once you give tacit acceptance to those views, that speaks towards the views of the entire institution. In terms of, well, if the university if the seminary considers Kaplan as part of their parsha, well, that says something about the seminary's thought. And then if Lieberman goes to the seminary, then, you know, through some transitive property, he must also, logically, agree to Kaplan to some extent. Because he agrees with the university who agrees with Kaplan. He agrees with the seminary that agrees with Kaplan. That would be how the logic would work, as I understand it. You could argue on the logic on different levels in terms of what is the seminary. Maybe by just being a part of it, you know, wouldn't. But it's a little bit difficult to say that when the seminary, you know, tried to promote itself as a legitimate Jewish option in America. And if you see from Finkelstein's quote on the first page, did define itself by its faculty. Meaning the fact that Lieberman was there, you know, to say it can't be as bad as you think of Saul if Lieberman sits on it today, you know, shows that, you know, that that's actually how they were working. And it's not uncommon for institutions to sort of talk out of two sides when it's more convenient. I mean, to say, are you a seminary, in which case you're just educating people in specific skills? Or are you saying that, no, each person is in fact advocating one thought or another? To give just one example from recent years at Yeshiva University, I found, and I've actually, you know, sent an email registering my disappointment, that the university is inconsistent regarding when they play the academic freedom card. So there have been times when certain Rosh Yeshiva have made controversial statements that have been published in the media, and the university's official position was, our faculty members have academic freedom. When they had a conference or, you know, some big forum on gays and Judaism, they came out, you know, after having permission to do it, and there was also some opposition from other rabbis, the university came out and, you know, made some statement that was a little, if not critical, certainly wasn't supportive of it, and didn't mention academic freedom. And in the letter, you know, that I, you know, sent, I said, you know, it's appropriate to say academic freedom. Like, I wasn't, you know, you're not going to censure faculty members in one case, but if you're going to play the academic freedom card, then you have to do that at least somewhat consistently. But on one hand, if you want to say that, you know, but Yeshiva University is, on one hand, wants to portray itself as a university, which would have academic freedom, but on the other hand, is also some, you know, bastion or flag bearer of modern Orthodox Judaism. And you can't have it both ways. Here was another case from this past year. A student group wanted to bring in Ethan Tucker, Rabbi Ethan Tucker from Machon Hadar, and there was some opposition about it, and I read in the commentator of the paper how they set up some sort of advisory board that would approve, like, speakers that would come in. And if you're an academic institution, a university, you know, shouldn't really matter. If a group wants to bring in someone, have them bring in and speak. So you have, you know, Yeshiva University is at least caught between two worlds with that on the university level. Rabbinical school is going to be a little bit different. So here you have a seminary, right? So on one hand, were they, you know, focusing on academic stuff of Judaic studies and, you know, training a new type of rabbinate, in which case it doesn't matter what the faculty members might think hashgafically if they can impart certain skills. Or are you also trying to promote an ideology, in which case whom you pick as a faculty member is of crucial importance? Yeah.
Since Yeshiva University takes federal funds that you're required to accept people, there's denominations, religions.
Yeah, there have been a bunch. Yeah.
All right. But can they exclude them from the rabbinical school if the rabbinical school is part?
So the rabbinical school, and they're very, you know, explicit about this, is not part of Yeshiva University. It's an affiliate. But George mentions, you know, because it goes federal, one of the funniest things I saw, when Rabbi Lamb had stepped down as president, YU had, published ads for the job opening, and they had at the bottom that they're an equal opportunity employer. And I couldn't help but laugh at that, because realistically, and, you know, part of me, the subversive side of me, thought it would have been really funny if, Professor Christine Hayes, who's a non-Jewish professor of Talmud at Yale, would have applied for the job. I mean, I've never met her, but it would have been interesting. I would assume she would have no interest in the position. But I just thought that little disclaimer at the bottom was really funny. At any rate, going back to the institutional side of things, that's, I think, why Kaplan's appointment by the university was important for the important for the seminary, and why, you know, you could argue in retrospect it was probably a really bad decision from the seminary that caused them to lose a great deal of credibility. If you're already going to be on the margins and you're already going to attract opposition, you don't make silly political moves like this, or you don't pick unnecessary fights. Now, it could be that not being part of the seminary, and I have no idea what went into his hiring one thing that we saw was that there weren't too many people that you could get to teach at the place. So you hire whom you can. There are times when, if you are too idealistic, you can make very silly political decisions to say, it's not going to matter, but it really does. Who knows?
Would you consider Rabbi Kahn, Aaron Kahn, as Braden?
I'm not going to poskin like who's already and who's not. I don't find such terms like that helpful.
But if Yeshiva University, Aaron Kosmider, said you have three people opportunity on Twitter, then Haredim could say, look, they're diluting what Yeshiva is supposed to do.
And they do.
They
do.
There are
world, YU is trade.
Yeah. There are people who just don't care about what goes on in YU because
it's an academic institution.
Yeah, and that depends on where you are. So one side is, if you are well-established enough, you can pretty much say, we don't care about what other people say or do, and what they do isn't going to affect us. So referring to, say, Mahon Hadar, Mahon Hadar is egalitarian, and they can legitimately say, since we don't, our existence is not conditional on any organizational approval, we don't care if someone accepts or rejects us, we can support ourselves. In the world of conservative versus orthodox at this time, and we saw some of Rav Moshe Feinstein's true votes, right, there was a real competition for the hearts and minds of, and souls, for lack of a better term, of everything of the American Jewish population. And it was a real competition of, it seems to be like one or the other. It's not like you have different jewels and you're achieving the same goal. There was an actual head-to-head going on here. So we'll see what the more modern side's, response to this stuff was going to be next week. The Haredi side, based on what we've seen before, none of this should be really surprising in terms of how things have manifest. Right? It's just interesting, I think, to see just how it came out. You see some of the rhetoric and some of the, modes of how things were, going about, means by which the opposition was communicated. All right? Any last questions? All right, so we'll see you next week. Thanks for coming out, and it's great to be back.